Sorry, I've been a little delayed there. I'm still recovering from yesterday. We're getting there. So this is a public hearing. This is the Subcommittee on Human Services. Public hearing on Senate Bill 5526, Oregon Health Authority, Addictions and Mental Health. Linda, any comments?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, we'll continue with the community mental health and addictions presentation today, and likely this presentation will go through tomorrow, and then the state hospital will be a separate presentation on Monday, so just in terms of timing.
Thank you.
Let's get started again and introduce yourself to the committee, and we're ready to roll here.
Thank you, Senator Bates, and members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Pam Martin, and I'm the director of the Addictions and Mental Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority, and with me are my colleagues.
For the record, Karen Wheeler, the Behavioral Health Administrator with the Addictions and Mental Health Division.
And for the record, Amy Baker, Child and Family Manager with Addictions and Mental Health.
So we're going to continue today talking about the programs using the same kind of visual picture that we presented yesterday, where a health plan is the brick and this is the mortar that goes around it to build a health home. And did you?
Just in case, for the record, I'm Kate Nash with the Department of Administrative Services.
Thank you. And we're going to finish with prevention.
Okay, so taking off from where we left yesterday, talking about prevention services, I just want to briefly say that prevention services are very much built on evidence. There's a science base to prevention. And conservatively, there is a cost benefit to prevention of $10 for every dollar spent. And that's very conservatively. One of the practices that we actually help implement around the state, and part of the new investments allowed us to expand these services, it's called Parent-Child Interaction Therapy, or PCIT. This is an evidence-based practice whereby parents learn better parenting skills for young kids. And some of these kids are, no joke, the kids that get kicked out of preschool because of their behaviors. We're getting some national attention around this practice, and Jackson County Mental Health actually provides the technical assistance for statewide implementation to Fidelity in this practice. There's a cost benefit. According to the Washington Institute for Public Policy, the cost benefit for every child who accesses this service is $3,427. And that plays itself out in reduced criminal justice, reduced juvenile justice, and societal outcomes, as well as health outcomes later on in life. We also fund, through our mental health block grant, mental health first aid. And we were able to do that with a contract through the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. And we've trained 1,557 people to administer first aid, mental health first aid.
Chair?
Sorry.
Thank you, Chair Bates. On the PCIT, to my understanding, that's a fairly new therapy or new practice. I know they've been studying it for a while, but what are the long-term outcomes as far as reducing like parental aggression and parenting and so forth? I have a foster son who goes to these therapies, so.
Okay. Chair Bates, members of the committee, Representative Stark, I am actually going to punt that question to Amy Baker, who oversees this program.
So basically, PCIT was designed specifically for that purpose. It was really to reduce aggressive behaviors, tantruming, those types of behaviors. And they've found in Oregon, we don't research this, but nationally we've found that there's been a benefit that's lasted out 6 years, at least 6 years beyond the treatment of PCIT in reducing those types of aggressive behaviors.
And follow up, just clarify, in reducing the aggressive behaviors in the child or in the parent, or both?
Well, it's both. Again, it's also been proven to reduce child abuse and neglect. But essentially what it does is it builds a foundation of a relationship between a parent and a child. You increase the parent's ability to be sensitive to their child's cues, to reflect back to them. You start to rebuild that relationship, and then once that happens, you really coach the parent in giving directions to the kids, to their young children, and then managing those tantrums. And so the kinds of reports that we've heard out of PCIT have been from parents saying, wow, my kid listens to me now, or my kid, like, we're so much closer, or my kid tells me that she loves me now and she never did that before. And so it's not actually just reducing behaviors, but it actually improves the relationship between the child and the parent.
Thank you.
And I want to ask a question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, go right ahead.
So, Amy, how long has this been around, PCIT?
So PCIT has been around nationally longer than it has been in Oregon. It started in Oregon prior to my stint here, but we had originally...
I don't know when that is, when your stint started.
Sorry, my stint's been about 2 years. Do you know when we started PCIT?
I believe we started PCIT at least 6 years ago in Oregon, if not seven. And it was an original investment from the Oregon Children's Plan.
Mm-hmm. And so it was originally started in about four counties, and we have now expanded it to 16 counties with about 30 sites implementing it.
Okay.
Val, can you describe the families that have children in preschool? Mm-hmm. Who are already having such intense behavioral problems mm-hmm. that you have to intervene? These are 2-, 3-, 4-year-old children.
Mm-hmm. So PCIT is designed for kids who are about 2 through age 6. After age 6, it's not nearly as effective. And I'm actually sad to say that there are more kids who get kicked out of preschool than high school. And it is in part because they have more extreme kind of tantruming, aggressive behaviors with other children in preschool, and without some kind of intervention, typically they end up getting kicked out. How the families look, you know, we're talking about families who are often living in poverty. They have high stress in being able to manage their kids. They may have parenting styles that are either too permissive, or they may have parenting styles that are too authoritarian. And what PCIT does is what you ideally want in parenting is you want a parent to be authoritative. You want them to be nurturing but firm. And so that's really what PCIT does, is it helps strike that balance.
Give me a little more picture of what these people look like, these parents. Are they having drug and alcohol problems? Are the parents themselves mentally ill? Are they extremely young and have no idea how to raise children?
All of the above. Yeah, so essentially, I mean, we could be talking about younger parents. We could be talking about parents who have been substance abusing. We could be talking about parents who are unemployed. We could be talking about parents who have had their own, as they were children, their own parenting experiences that weren't optimal, and so they never really learned how to do that in an appropriate way.
Are these children likely into the criminal system later because of oppositional defiant disorders? I mean, is this where it comes from?
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, yes. It's why this service has such a soft spot in my heart, in part because we have the opportunity to intervene early. But basically, I think if you look at the research, you will find that kids are more likely to end up in the justice system if the parents are overly permissive than if they're overly authoritarian. And so what PCIT does is it really gives the ability for parents to set appropriate limits on their kids early on so that they have a chance to then be successful in school.
Mr. Chair, I just have to...
Senator Winters.
What you mentioned research, and what data exists in Oregon that sets out that this group is likely, and how many of them end up in our criminal justice system? That's a very broad statement that you made. So, what is the real data that exists for us along that paradigm that you described?
Chair Bates, Senator Winters, I don't have data specific to Oregon because we do not have a research entity attached to this program. What I am citing when I say that is national evidence based out of the international PCIT group.
Given that we've just gone through severe recession. And I mean severe. I mean, so the poverty look in Oregon is probably far greater than maybe some other parts of the country. And, you know, I noticed that one of your sets is living in poverty. So that would suggest, and plus, you know, either you're at one extreme or the other, and if I combine the testimony that came out about our high percentage of alcohol and drug use and what have you, it would suggest that we would have a tremendous large population in the state of Oregon that would fall in these categories that you're suggesting. Can you help me really think that that's true?
Chair Bates, Senator Winters, let me clarify your question. So you're asking if there is a large percentage of kids who would benefit from this service?
That's not my question. My question is, you know, we set up things is because within our universe or within our state, there is a large number of individuals that would benefit from this kind of intervention based on those demographics or these that you cited. One was poverty. Mm-hmm. Two was permissiveness, and then strictness on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. So you've got this big spectrum that exists. And three, alcohol and drug and some of the other things that we, you know, those behaviors that would call for the need for intervention. And I just want to know, what numbers are we talking about?
Chair Bates, Senator Winters, and let me add one more piece to the list that you just cited. The kids who end up in PCIT are also starting to have some behavioral issues, so they're getting referred in for
have
that
reason.
Have you
ever had a 2-year-old?
Yes.
I think you started from two.
I have
4 sons, so I'm speaking from the standpoint of a mother who raised 4 sons, and of course, in my years when I grew up, everybody was in poverty. So, so speaking from that framework, and a 2-year-old, and if you've got a 2-year-old, they're acting out in 2-year-olds. And I think most mothers that are listening would say it was pretty traumatic.
Terrible twos. That said, I'd like to see the federal data.
I think it is
multifactorial, but I'm going to disagree with my senator here because I don't know any better. I have a hunch, just a gut feeling, that it's not just poverty and drugs. It's probably how the parenting is happening is a bigger factor, we might think. I know a lot of families in poverty, and they keep a pretty close eye on their kids. Those kids do pretty good. And I know some well-to-do families.
Whose kids don't do so good.
Who are, spoiled kids rotten, and they grow up and they're in trouble. So there's something there, but I've never seen any objectively studying it. So I'd like to see the data.
Chair, may I?
Yeah.
Thank you. I do want to remind you guys that for PCIT, so yes, there's all these different risk factors that, you know, psychopathology and development that you can study and kind of predict a little bit how more at risk one child is over another. And that's what, you know, Amy was just talking about, the different risk factors. However, to my understanding, so correct me if I'm wrong, PCIT, these children have come on, it's not just we think they'll turn out this way. They've come onto the radar for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They may have gotten kicked out of Head Start, or a study I recently had the opportunity to watch, DHS had actually encouraged this training for the parent to go do that, and that was one of the visits, is this parent was able to see their children that were in foster care through this visit on a PCIT study and work through some of those things. So this isn't you have risk factors, let's throw you in here. you have risk factors and you're already showing the symptoms that you are one of these children, and we're trying to deal with that before it gets worse.
And Co-Chair Bates and Senator Winters, I want to completely concur with that. Poverty in itself does not lead to poor parenting. There are plenty of families who live in poverty who do a great job raising their children. It's a risk factor, but it does not lead to kids being referred into PCIT. And it's true that it's basically kids are having problems beyond what is developmentally expected for their age. That's how they get referred in.
I think that's a better way of describing. I think for me, I'm getting a little bothered about everything that comes before us that defined in that is, quote, poverty, quote, unquote, or race, quote, unquote.
Yeah.
And I'm getting very troubled by that, because that's not a truism.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other factors that in the well-being of children, irrespective of some of those, because Dr. Bates is right. I still say call him Doc. You have some families that are in abject poverty that have done a tremendous job in raising their children. You've got on the other end, as he cited, who have an abundance of wealth, and those kids turn out that have other problems that we don't expect or should not expect, because wealth is not the only thing that means that we've got good character and good nurturing and what have you. So I guess I want to make certain that we don't constantly throw in those categories when we're talking about some of these issues. And I see my friend down there.
Senator Steiner, here with you, then there was a hand up down here. No, okay.
I just want to clarify, and I apologize, I had to come in late. I was being a doctor instead of being a senator. This program is not solely available to parents of lower socioeconomic status. Is this one of the programs that's available to any family who's struggling? Mm-hmm. And how do you, now putting my doctor hat back on for a second, as a family physician, if I saw a family where I thought that they would benefit from this, how would I know about this? It's the first I've ever heard of it. Now, I'm not doing a lot of, regular well child care anymore. I'm busy otherwise. But I still work with residents a lot, and so I don't know that they know about these programs when they've got kids or families that are at risk. How are we educating the frontline providers, the family physicians, the nurse practitioners, the pediatricians who are seeing these kids?
These are the sites.
About the availability of this program, because there are definitely families in every socioeconomic strata that would benefit.
Co-Chair Bates, Senator Steiner Hayward, a couple things. One is we have the list of sites that are doing PCIT available on our website, for one. The other piece that we've been doing with a different project, which is the Adolescent Depression Screening Project, is that Oregon Pediatric Society has been traveling all over the state of Oregon, basically working with primary care around what the mental health resources are that are available to those primary care clinics within their region. We've not hit every primary care clinic by any small stretch of the imagination, but we have had at least four regional efforts out into the community to really make folks aware of what the services are that are available.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you. Please carry on. Thank you very much, both chairs. So great, that's fabulous. I would just suggest that since there are a lot of counties in this state that only have family physicians and nurse practitioners and PAs, that you also connect with the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, because the two organizations partner together a lot, but they do serve different parts of the state. There are a lot of parts of the state that don't have pediatricians,
right,
and they may not automatically come onto the radar of the Pediatric Society, even though the two organizations work together a lot. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just a quick question.
Sure.
Because we're talking about helping, intervening when there's some behavior issues from 2 to 6, and I've often thought, and in fact we did have some legislation that was didn't go through. In fact, I believe Senator Bates and voted for it as well back in 99 and 2001. Show you how long this has been, because of the need that we understand that individuals don't come here with the skill of being parents. And particularly since we've become so mobile and moving in our society, mm-hmm. so no longer do grandparents and mm-hmm. parents and others exist to help us with this particular job. And so as such, I believe it was Judge Thornton who frequent, I believe it was Japan often, and said, you know, they teach parenting. And so, you know, we thought we could emulate that, because then that would get us at the front end of preventing mm-hmm. this lack of parenting and nurturing that you're talking about that exists. And I've often thought that probably that should be really a pathway that we should take, because, you know, honestly, we don't come here with all of the skill sets, nor do we have the parents and somebody to call. Mm-hmm. So have you given any thought to that approach to the work that you're doing?
Do you want to take that?
Yeah. Thank you for that question, Chairs Bates, Nathanson, Senator Winters. I would like to just wrap up by saying that there are a list of evidence-based, parent-based, community-based, school-based prevention strategies that are being implemented in Oregon. I'm not going to go through the entire list, but this list are programs that are funded by AMH through counties, public health departments, and what remains of the Commission on Children and Families in counties. And it's across the lifespan. So there's parenting education classes for people who have middle school age students, for children in high school. So it's not just around the young kids, the 2 to 6 year olds. We really need a sustained effort to provide immunizations and booster sessions, if you will, for people, for parenting, parenting that really is effective at reducing risk factors and building protective factors for people in the long run.
Could you provide us with your list?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Madam Chair. That.
Well, good. So it looks like we're ready to move to the second slide.
Madam Chair. Madam Justice.
Senator Bates.
So when you give us the list, I'd also like to know where PCIT therapy, where PCIT really is happening, and if there's a wait list to get into these programs, and how you actually identify the kids that you think need to go into it and offer the program to them, and how many of the families, once you offer that program, actually go into the program.
Okay.
And what are the outcomes? Thank you.
So I'm finished up with prevention and segueing to early intervention.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Olson.
Karen, really quick. Do you have kind of a number what the percentage or success ratio is, success rate of that, Amy? I find that interesting.
So for PCIT, and PCIT, obviously, it's an evidence-based practice. It's very rigorous in terms of how they identify success. And so to graduate from PCIT, basically what it means is the child has to fall within the normal range that any other child would fall in with or without PCIT. So the number of kids who graduated from PCIT, about 76.7% of them ended PCIT services with behavior in the normal range, which from my standpoint is pretty phenomenal. And 62% of the parent-child pairs showed improvement in their relationship.
Very good. Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you. We'd like to, Madam Chair, I know we got to go, and give us that data. How long you tracked them? What you consider normal behavior, how you measure that behavior, do we really have solid outcomes? I don't want self-reporting by the parents. Yeah, things are okay now. Let's give that to us later. We've got to move on.
So this is me, early identification and intervention. So essentially, a total of 13 to 20% of children living in the United States experience a mental health disorder in any given year. And according to the Center for Disease Control, for the surveillance that they did between 1994 and 2011, they showed that these conditions appear to be increasing. Now, I don't know if that scares you But that scares me a little bit. And what that says to me is that we really need to be able to get ahead of this. And part of the question is why? I mean, why do we see kids having increasing mental health disorders? And I don't have a firm answer for you for that, but one of the studies that's come up in the last 20 years that's really shed some light on the current situation is the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. And I don't know how many of you are familiar or aware of that study, but essentially, in 1997, CDC and Kaiser completed a study of about 17,000 individuals. And with those 17,000 individuals, they found that the original study was based on a group of folks who were trying to address obesity issues. And through that process, what they found was that adults who had significant health issues, they could essentially track that back to early childhood experiences. And even more so, what they had found was that there were a specific set of childhood experiences that directly linked to health risk behaviors and then later, you know, poor health outcomes for adults, incarceration, unemployment, and other situations like that. And the adverse childhood experiences included things like sexual abuse, physical abuse, neglect, domestic violence, incarceration of a parent, substance abuse of a parent, mental illness in a parent, and loss of a parent due to death or divorce. And through all of this, they've estimated that the cost of child maltreatment is around $124 billion a year. And that is through the healthcare, its criminal justice system, its education, its lost productivity, and essentially children who have experienced four or more ACEs had 4 to 12-fold increase in health risks for alcoholism, drug abuse, depression, and suicide attempts. So this is all bad news. The key piece to that, though, is that as much as we're learning about ACEs, we're also learning about resiliency. And that resiliency is essentially a protective factor. And that just because you have a lot of ACEs as a child, it doesn't mean that you're not going to be a productive adult. And that, in fact, one of the primary factors of resilience is relationship. And that's the work that we do in mental health. We are all about building, repairing, creating, and finding relationships for kids. So what are we doing to address ACEs? With the last legislative investment, we've invested $800,000 in a collaborative between PSU, OHSU, and Oregon Pediatric Society, basically to collect best practices on what people are doing in terms of trauma-informed care. How do you prevent ACEs? How do you remediate ACEs? And how do we train our healthcare professionals who see all of these kids and families in their practice, as well as in child welfare and mental health, that we as a system have to be better prepared to deal with our clients who've had some really tough experiences, and to stop treating them like there's something wrong with them and start treating them like, what happened to you? What happened to you, not what's wrong with you? And so this collaborative through PSU, OHSU, and OPS is called Trauma Informed Oregon. And year to date, they've developed a website to start collecting all of this information, to disseminate information, and they've trained over 1,000 individuals around the whole study of ACEs. Additionally, we are working on increasing the implementation of ESPRT. And ESPRT is the Screening and Brief Information and Referral to Treatment. It is a CCO metric, and it is evidence-based. And from July 1st, 2013 through June 30th, 2014, 9,186 patients have been screened for the ESPRT. Now, so why is the ESPRT?
Just quick question, Mr. Chair. Is it information or referral or intervention or referral?
Information. Thank you.
You did say that. It's just the slides.
It's intervention.
It's intervention.
Sorry.
Intervention.
It could be both.
Okay.
No.
Well, actually, I mean, not to be difficult, but it is intervention, for a reason, because it, I mean, yes, you provide information, but that's the referral piece.
Right.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot, Ms. Baker, I apologize, but we do this a lot in our practice and our, you know, so it's something that, the point is to say, this matters, we care about you, here are the things we need to
right.
do. It is informational, but it's also like, yes, this is
right.
important, we're going to intervene here and do something.
Correct. And the reason, which you so eloquently just stated, why it's so important is it allows us to intervene early, so that we're actually screening for problems before people get to the point where they start to have bad outcomes. AMH hired an expert specialist to basically coordinate the implementation effort, promote training, solve billing challenges, connect with medical clinics so that medical clinics actually have some place to refer people to. In addition to on the adult side, we're also doing it on the adolescent side for both substance abuse and depression screening, so that we're able to, particularly for adolescents, when there's a heightened risk for suicide, I think it's really important to implement the ESPERT. And with the Adolescent Health Project, year-to-date, we've had about 173 people trained, 108 primary care providers from 11 counties. So Young Adult Hubs and ESA are the last two programs that I'm going to talk about on this slide. And AMH is very committed to the young adult population, and in part, it's because it's a very vulnerable time period for young people. Research has shown that the prefrontal cortex does not fully mature until about the mid-20s, and yet young people become adults at age 18. And so what that means is that our service delivery system has to become very adept at engaging them into services. And that's what we've done with the young adult hubs. We currently have four hubs. They serve 12 counties. Who the hubs are designed to serve are the kids who have been in the child welfare system for a very long time. They've probably had they've had therapy, they may have been in OYA. They're at great risk of being homeless, of being incarcerated, of being hospitalized. And all four hubs use a strategy to use young adult peers to basically engage them into service. Because frankly, sitting down and meeting with a therapist is not going to be super enticing when you are 18 years old, especially if you've had two that have come before you. And so, through the young adult hubs, we have, since 2014, over 500 young adults have been referred into the hubs. 300 have been enrolled, and 221 are currently active in the four different programs. And within 6 months of this service getting up and running, we had every single slot full. It is a very highly demanded service, and the reports that I'm hearing is that it's been really successful at serving kids that we would never have been able to serve otherwise. The counties, the areas that have the hubs, we have one in the metro area, we have one in Central Oregon, we have one down in Jackson and Josephine, and we have one in Lane County.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. Quick question, are you planning to spread that statewide?
Well, I would love to, Representative Kenny Geyer.
Okay. Just a question of funding, then.
Yes.
There's a very cool map we're going to see in a minute.
Yeah. Which is ESA coming up. And then lastly, I want to talk about the ESA, which is the Early Assessment and Support Alliance.
Senator Bates.
Do you have measurable outcomes for the program?
I do not. I am waiting on our MOTS system to start delivering measurable outcomes for that program.
Thank you.
So the Early Assessment and Support Alliance, that is a homegrown Oregon program that started in the Willamette Valley. And it was based on some national evidence of programs that had worked and was able to demonstrate outcomes here in Oregon. And so it was expanded to 18 counties. So that's pretty much where it was prior to the 2013 investment. Now it's available in 32 counties. And so what ESA is, for folks who aren't aware, is that it is a team-based approach to young people age 14 to 25 who are experiencing their first psychotic break. And the intent of ESA is to mobilize quickly. In fact, the average time of referral from the date a kid is referred to when they're seen is 2 days, about 90% of the time, because basically when a young person experiences their first psychotic break, there is absolutely no time to lose.
I'm going to ask you a question here. You said that about 2 days. What happens between the moment... What's happening in that 2 days? Something happened, someone picked up the phone, sent an email, whatever, contacted someone else. What's happening in the 2 days? Is it nothing or something is happening?
Typically, the way that referrals happen is, one, somebody gets referred in, and generally speaking, most social workers within the ESA program, they have a caseload of folks. And so it's coordinating who your caseload is and who's going to be able to pick that person up, and then figuring out how to get the initial assessment to happen, and coordinating the date that they're going to meet. It's all the pre-coordination of getting that appointment to happen.
I'm thinking about it from the perspective of the young person who has experienced a psychotic break, as you described. Something happened. That person's someone at school, a family member, someone picked up the phone to initiate help. For this young person, what's happening in that two-day period? Where are they, and what's happening because of even losing 48 hours or a little more? Are things continuing to progress and spiral downwards, or is there something, as some kind of triage, that's coming in to help stabilize the situation quickly?
It's actually not unusual for the referrals to actually come in through the hospital. So there is some percentage of these young people who show up at the hospital, and the hospital social workers are the ones who call and make the referral into ESA. There's also situations where it may be a mental health provider the person is being seen, but they haven't... They're starting to develop psychosis, but they haven't yet. And then there are others that may be at home, and it's a matter of the family kind of supporting them and keeping them safe until we can get the referral to happen. But really, referrals come from all over the place.
I think my final comment that I'd like to leave with is, if this young person is at home, and not in a hospital or some other residential setting where someone can be watching out for them. If they're at home, is there any information provided to people around them what to do, what not to do, before there's a more intense professional involvement? I'm thinking about if you call 911 and there's a situation that involves your physical health, someone is often on the other end of the line to tell you, you need ice, you need to put pressure on a wound, you need to do this, you need to do that, until emergency medical support arrives or until the person gets to the hospital. Is there some advice given to people
what
to do to stabilize the situation?
I would say, Chairs and Representative Nathanson, I would say that if the parent calls a crisis line, which we have crisis lines all around the state, then yes, I think there would be information that would come with that. In absence of that, in absence of reaching out and contacting a mental health professional, I'm not sure.
It's just something for us to think about.
Can I make a comment here, please?
Yes, Senator Bates.
Let's not put lipstick on a pig here. We threw a bunch of money at this program, and I appreciate that. You showed Jackson County is having an early assessment and support alliance program, and we in fact don't. I've tried to access it many times. I've talked to you about a case. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work. It's not functioning. Okay. It's a really difficult situation. When a young person first starts having auditory or other hallucinations or becoming psychotic, they often won't seek treatment no matter what the family wants them to do, what the doctor wants them to do. The process still is ultimately end up in the emergency department and then get hopefully transferred to a treatment center. Usually we have to find a bed somewhere in the state. My last case ended up in John Day from Jackson County. Family had to take him up there. Let's not kid ourselves about this. We have three or four places in the state that I know of right now who are moving rapidly to a better way of doing this. They're setting up mental health institutions. Those patients will not be going to ERs anymore. They're not going to be going into prisons anymore. We're going to try to bring them to one place that family can bring them, a doctor can send them, 24/7 availability in the Portland area, possibly 24/7 psychiatrists. Now there's places really ready to work and take care of this. I just got to tell you, I don't think this is doing what you think it's doing. For those of us in the trenches, nothing has changed, at least in Jackson County, from my point of view. It's a step in the right direction. But we really need to develop programs that when someone is ready to be treated, they've got a 24/7 place to go with good people there who are competently trained and can do the work that needs to be done. The 48-hour gap is serious, but it's even worse than that. And you know many of these patients have been hearing voices for weeks before they say anything to anybody else, or they've been seeing things for weeks, or they've been acting out for weeks before we see them. And we also know that they have to be treated immediately, because that first break is the one you've got to stop so they'll continue to have more breaks in the future. So I would ask that we really look seriously at not just a program that looks like a nice map I'm looking at here, but real things on the ground. These patients and these people get the help they need right now, real time, and get a program going that does that. I'm seeing that pop up around the state from local communities doing what they need to do because they're tired of seeing this too. So I think we're moving in the right direction here, but let's not kid ourselves about what actually is getting done, and let's really support things going on in Marion County, things going on in the next 18 months up in the Tri-County area. Roseburg wants a program, and I'll talk to you later about it. Pam, I talked to him last night. They had a meeting last week with police and commissioners, everybody ready to roll. These are the things we really need to do. This is the real heart of what's going on. So I appreciate your presentation. I appreciate you telling us. We need to do a lot more, and I think we can do it if we work together.
Thank you. Let's move on.
Okay. So we're moving into talking about community treatment. We've talked about prevention, early intervention. AMH supports the service delivery system in Oregon. As we've mentioned, we provide infrastructure support for the adoption and implementation of evidence-based practices. And I'd like to say that these practices are more expensive and require an investment, particularly in the early stages when a program is being implemented and staff have to be trained and hired. I have some experience doing this in Lane County for a prison and jail-based population. And it is very rigorous. It requires specific supervision, so supervisors have to be trained in the practice as well. So that's what we support at AMH. And we also support a base set of crisis services and safety net services through community mental health programs.
Madam Chair, can I ask Karen a question? Since you mentioned, you know, the public safety part of it, and both Senator Bates and I and others, and Representative Olson sit on public safety, and I think it's a good thing that we're also on human services. Because in doing so, we're beginning to see those gaps. And I'm just going to clearly state it. We're just beginning to see the gaps between the service delivery where you have on this hand what the public safety people are encountering and then what you deliver as a service. Are you thinking about, you know, and going forward in the future, and the center and I talked about it, to where everybody's getting together of talking about how we're going to actually work and not just say the word collaboration, but how we're going to work to begin to deliver the services that you come and tell us that are going on in County X, what's not going on in County Y, or that needs to be in Z. You know, so that we're not continually to operate in this county by county if they happen to agree, but where we actually come out with a statewide plan and then put the pieces together how we're going to execute it.
Mm-hmm. Chairs Bates, Nathanson, and Senator Winters, yes, I have quite an extensive history collaborating with the Department of Corrections and with the Oregon Youth Authority, as well as juvenile departments, and the Central and Eastern Oregon Juvenile Justice Consortium, the Criminal Justice Commission. I think we have the base of very good collaboration to make some things happen. I feel like we're on the cusp of doing some great things because we have the we have ACA and Medicaid expansion. People in jails don't have Medicaid. People in prisons don't have Medicaid. So there's an opportunity for us to reach in and really start working with people before they get out and provide that bridge so that there's a familiar face, a familiar program for them to go to when they get out, and to really not lose any time there. And I think that was mentioned yesterday by either yourself or Senator Bates, that it's a critical moment when somebody gets out of jail or prison. We already know that you don't want to release people on Friday at midnight. That's a bad idea. And there's some protocols and practices, standards that we can put into place that relate to the behavioral health and the treatment system that support that as well, better outcomes when people get out of jails and prisons. So I'm very excited about doing that and working on that. I did that, like I said, in Lane County. We had a bridge program. We literally called it the bridge program. And it was funded by money that came from the state, that came to the county, but it was also funded in partnership by county funds, because counties also receive local beer and wine tax funds. They also have their own general funds that they can put toward these services. So there's a braiding, like I mentioned yesterday, of these funds to make these services happen on the ground. So yes, I'm very excited about that. Since this is a budget presentation again, I will mention that the governor's balanced budget authorizes $484.7 million to community mental health in our budget, $93.4 million to the alcohol and drug treatment budget, and $8.1 million to the problem gambling services. And of that, general fund represents $281.3 million for community mental health, $32.2 million general fund for alcohol and drug services, and of course lottery pays for problem gambling services, both treatment and prevention. We also yes.
Could you give that in writing to every committee member?
Yes, and it is in the presentation as well later on in the slides. We also received some tobacco tax last session for the legislative new investments. Individuals are referred to treatment from a variety of sources, and as was mentioned yesterday, a large portion, especially of the alcohol and drug treatment system, is referred by the justice system. So the top referral source is DUII, people who are arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants, and they have to go and see an evaluator, and then they get referred to treatment. We also have people that are placed under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. There's about 300 people on average that are under the PSRB. We have specialty courts, mental health courts, drug treatment courts, and some other kind of combination specialty courts that serve people with behavioral health conditions. We have referrals that come from the juvenile departments, the Oregon Youth Authority, community supervision, parole and probation. And as I mentioned, some people participate in treatment while they're incarcerated.
Do you have a priority on your referrals as to who gets what service? And I ask that because it came up when we did the review of specialty courts, since you mentioned specialty courts, and that's the one that I chaired on 3194, and the issue that came out that often there may or may not be treatment services available. So how do you prioritize, or how do you say that this one has a greater at top of the list than somebody else?
Chair Spates, Nathanson, and Senator Winters, there is a priority ordering for the people who access treatment. And I think one of the challenges is that we all have our lenses. So the criminal justice community has their lens. They see people getting arrested. The judges see people coming before them, sometimes over and over again, in the same families, generation after generation. The treatment people have our lens. We see this as a disease, as a chronic illness, as a lifelong condition to be managed. So there are tools to prioritize people who access treatment based on criminal recidivism and risk factors. And there's also tools that prioritize people based on the medical needs. So those two things don't always go hand in hand. There's not always a great collaboration around that. Our contracts, however, do require the prioritization of people from the DHS, child welfare. That's one of the populations we prioritize. Drug court clients are prioritized. The problem is there's a list of people that are prioritized, and the local communities develop a local plan based on statute, and they determine what their priorities are, working with judges, the judicial system, the local public safety coordinating councils, working with the mental health advisory committees. I mean, there's a lot of people that are taking part in planning a local system because we have strong local control in this state. Okay. Pregnant women, thanks, Pam. Our Black grant requires us to prioritize pregnant women. That's the top priority of people who access treatment. And second to that are people who use IV drugs, who are using intravenously. And that goes back to prevention for the conversation that was taking place yesterday around hepatitis C and infectious diseases. We have to prioritize folks that are using IV drugs. Okay, so I'm not going to belabor the specific kinds of treatment because that would take too long. I'm just going to say that we have services that span a continuum from acute care, psychiatric services, detoxification services. These are services people need right away. There's no time to waste. And then we have outpatient treatment happening in every county and every tribe. And we have regional residential treatment centers that are around the state for alcohol and drug and mental health services. So the next slide talks about our residential programs. And those fall into a continuum when we're talking about mental health residential.
Are we going to be looking at a map?
We don't have a map. Well, we could provide a map for residential treatment services.
We do have a map. It's not on here.
It's not
a copy of it. Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
So the residential mental health environments are organized from least to most restrictive, adult foster homes being the least restrictive, and secure residential treatment facilities being the most restrictive. Mental health residential is a covered service through the Oregon Health Plan. Right now, it's billed on a fee-for-service basis. And we're in the process of working very hard with the medical assistance programs to transition this benefit over to the CCOs right now. I don't know a hard date for when that's going to happen, but there are a lot of things that have to take place. They're all documented in a project plan. And people are working extremely hard to make sure that this happens over the next year and a half or so, 2 years.
Senator Bates.
Yeah, this seems to be a particular problem. Part of what we call the back door, front door, being hopefully someday mental and drug and alcohol treatment centers in each major city and across the state, which we don't have yet. But they're still concerned about the back door when they leave that after 24 hours to up to a week, where these people go and not just out onto the bridge and come back in again. What's your sense of actual housing we have out there? I seem to get different stories, different parts of the state when I talk to people. Portland's got some, they're concerned they don't have enough. Roseburg knows they don't have enough. It just seems to be a hodgepodge, and no one seems to have a good, clear idea of what these homes look like, what they can do, who should be there, how long they should be there, how do we do wraparound services if we don't have people in some kind of housing that's where they're safe, not out in the street. What, do you have a sense of this? Have you done a study of this? Have you tried to look at it? Where the funding comes from for this? Housing doesn't seem to want to get very involved, although I hear now they're starting to get involved. They're thinking maybe this is something they should be involved with. Give me a sense of this thing.
Senator Bates, excellent question, and it's something that we consider on a daily basis. It's very important for people when they leave a really secure setting or an intensive setting environment that they have adequate housing and supportive housing when they leave. We have just completed a housing inventory working with Housing and Community Services and through a contract. I forget the contractor's name, but we just completed that, and we'll have the results of that survey up on our website as of today or tomorrow, I believe, and it lists out all the affordable housing in the state of Oregon during that survey period, and we're going to update that as we get new information working with Oregon Housing and Community Services. And importantly, too, it's the housing, but it's also the supports that go along with a person when they leave a residential program or leave the state hospital. One of the services that I'm extremely excited about that we're seeing great results and we need to capture the data around it is peer-delivered services, mentoring and coaching so that somebody does not have any time between getting out of one of these programs. Ideally, somebody's working with them when they're in it and then bridges them back out into the community. But they have a familiar face, they have somebody who can really navigate with them through all kinds of systems, even down to the bus schedule. How do you take the bus? Let's go get you some pots and pans. Let's really help you be successful when you get out. So this is what we're really wanting to put in place in every community throughout the state. It is available, but as you said, it's not to scale, and we really want to make that happen. So thank you for that question.
Madam Chair, as a follow-up to that, not just the inventory, which is important, but also what the waiting lists look like and the difficulty of getting into those homes and disparities in different parts of the state.
We will get you some information on that.
Madam Chair, just a 50-foot question, and you can ponder it and come back and answer it later. But I was sitting here thinking of all the various initiatives that we're doing and what's occurring across the state. And it came to my, to me, the question, are we any healthier today looking at our budget, how our budgets are putting together and looking at how what we funded in 2011 versus where we are today in 2015? Because we can talk about programs infinitum. And my interest is, are we healthier in Oregon, and in our mental health community than we were 5, 10 years ago, and I think, and I want you to think about it. The other question I'd like for you to think about, and I know that it's being discussed, and that's whether or not what treatment actually works, and whether we're talking about the alcohol treatment. And I know we do all these wonderful contracts, and I know that it's a disease that often you have to have more than one, maybe two, maybe even four or five. But what really, in your view, is actually that if we were going to talk about long-term investment, where should we be investing?
Chair Faison and Senator Winters, thank you for that question. You're just inspiring me as you ask these questions, and we're never going to get through this. But I really, really am devoted, and we are at AMH, and the Oregon Health Authority is devoted to people being healthier. That is our primary mission. That is our goal. And we are putting together, and hearing Lynn Saxton talk yesterday was inspiring as well. We're really putting together a system where we can track these outcomes. You already know that the CCOs have metrics. They have measures that measure how healthy their populations are getting. And we have measures as well. So putting these together in a way and analyzing them in a way that will tell us the story about how healthy Oregon is and also tell each community and county how healthy their counties are is something near and dear to our hearts. We do have surveillance data. We have information that is based on survey data that public health collects. We have the student wellness survey data that we collect about youth. We have the Oregon Healthy Teen Survey that is conducted by public health. And then we also have, and I'm going to trip on this, I always do, behavioral risk factor surveillance survey that public health does. And I'm sure my colleagues will call me up right after this hearing and tell me I said it wrong. But we do have ways of collecting data on populations, but to your point, we do need to collect data on how healthy our populations are getting who access services that are paid for with our funds. And I do have information based on a study that we conducted. Representative Richardson asked for a study several years ago, and we commissioned it through NPC Research, and we followed alcohol and drug clients who'd gotten treatment through our publicly funded system. So we looked at things like abstinence. Basically, that's the top thing we look at. But we also looked at other outcomes, like were they getting better medically? Did they have better mental health outcomes? And they did. We will get you this fact sheet that overviews this entire study. And if you want to read the whole study, I can get you that too.
Give them just two examples.
So we had, after 1 year, and again, these people were followed up on by researchers and evaluators who were talking to them face-to-face. We didn't ask for their urine, so in case that's your next question, but they were talking to people and interviewing them, there was a 93% reduction in amphetamine use, an 83% reduction in heroin use, a 78% reduction in cannabis use, and I could go on, prescription drug use. So we will get to that.
I'm going to interrupt with one. Taking it a step farther, when we think about some of the other measures that we're tracking, not by individual but overall, use of emergency department, for example, one of the assumptions is that if you're taking better care of yourself, if you're reducing overuse, even if it's just not abuse, but overuse of alcohol or drugs, that you will take better care of yourself, and you will then see less frequent use of the emergency department or other sorts of adverse events in the physical health side, not only the behavioral health side. So if you have anything eventually that would support that, that would be interesting to know. Because, it's investing money upstream. When we're talking about kids, the earlier the intervention, the better. But also upstream, if we can prevent or stop or reverse overuse of things that cause you to take less good care of your body, whether it's oral health or some other physical health, that should pay off. It pays off double, not only in one silo or one part of our investment area.
Absolutely right. Okay, so I know we've spent too much time probably on this topic, and I had a lot more to say, but I won't.
Representative Boone has a point also.
But thank you, and I just want to take a moment to thank our Governor Kitzhaber's long vision in all this. This is started a long time ago in the 80s with the Oregon Health Plan, as it was, and a really heavy push on prevention, which is what you're doing now, and this is, I think, what's going to really take us over the finish line, and I really appreciate his leadership and vision on that, and thank you for what you're doing, putting this into place.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, so I have some other numbers to throw out here, but I won't. But we have information about how many people access these various types of residential treatment. We can provide that to you later or now. And I know there's going to be some other informational hearings, perhaps on crisis services and housing later on, but we do touch on that later in our presentation, so thank you. Assertive community treatment, we just wanted to show you another pretty map of this service and where it existed before the mental health new investments, and then the second map is where it exists now after the mental health new investments. This was a we did an RFP, a request for proposals, and we funded 10 CCOs to develop the infrastructure to be able to provide assertive community treatment, which is an evidence-based practice. This service, to your point, Senator Bates, helps people to stay in their communities so they don't go into a residential program, or it picks them up right after a residential program when they need really intensive support in the community that's around this person night and day, every single day. Okay, and now we're transitioning back to kids and the treatment system for kids, unless there's any other comments or questions.
I have one quick question, and I asked this of another panel, and you can think about it and get back. But I asked the question, if you were to pick one state that actually is actually implementing some of these broad goals and objectives and keeping their state healthy as it relates to mental health, which state would it be?
Let me answer this one. I would pick Oregon, Senator Winters. The ESA program, the extent is receiving, for example, is receiving national and international recognition, because there's no other state in the whole union that has this kind of attention paid to early psychosis. Whether it's completely working perfectly is, of course, we can always do better, and we will do better. And the fact that we have 94.6% of our population covered by some kind of health insurance is the foundation for being able to do all the rest of these things. So I can't, when I go to meetings and talk to commissioners from other states, they are envious and wanting to know about what's happening in Oregon. So there's no other state that I know of that's making the advances that have been made here.
And I'll throw in, we're one of only two states that has a residential problem gambling service.
Yes, and we all go to these national meetings and we all brag on what we're doing. And I, you know me, I'm an outcomes person and I'm a data-driven person. And so I asked that question because I know also CDC and others also collect data. I'm talking about the health of states, and it's not just the physical health, but mental health as well. So I just wanted to think about where we land in that, because I think we can always do better. And so if I look at the thing of homeless and that particular population or what have you, where are we? If I look at the issue of and not just ESA, and not just the programs that we put in place, but what are our outcomes? And that's why I ask you to think about it. Because we can always, I think, do better, and I'm not of the mindset that says that, you know, that we're at the top of the heap, because if we're at the top of the heap, then that means that we don't have to change anything that we're doing.
Thank you, Senator Winters. I'd like to make sure that Ms. Wheeler is able to make some more progress with getting through the presentation this morning. I don't want to leave a schedule problem for my co-chair for tomorrow. We're on slide number 23 of 58 slides to complete by tomorrow. So I'd like to get at least a few more done and have my co-chair not unhappy about the pressure for tomorrow.
I just say, Madam Chair, they're slow.
You said they're slow. Or we're back to you.
Yes.
Okay.
So, for on the record, Amy Baker, Child and Family with Addictions and Mental Health, co-chairs. I'm going to present the community treatment for kids, and I'm going to be really fast. So House Bill 2144 created the statewide Children's Wraparound Initiative, and this is back in 2009. And the goal was to basically expand that statewide by 2015. And at this point, we are just shy of that goal, with 13 CCOs having wraparound as a benefit that they provide and three CCOs that do not. People use the term wraparound all the time, and I want to explain what we mean by that. Wraparound is essentially it's a planning process, and it's a planning process for kids who are multi-system involved. So they may have child welfare, they may have special education, they may have criminal justice. And in a less than ideal world, you have all of these adult professionals making their own plans in absence of each other and basically driving families crazy. In a step up from that world, you have some of these folks
occasionally talking to each other and maybe some coordination, but the family has no real voice into what happens. In an ideal world with wraparound, you actually have a planning process where the family and the young adult are driving what their plan is going to be, and it's based on what their strengths and what their needs are. And what we've seen, from what we started and where we have and what we have now, the results that we've seen is that kids are more stable in their placement, which, as you know, is imperative to developing attachments. The worst thing you can do to kids is move them from place to place to place. What we've also seen is that they have the overall cost of mental health services is somewhere between 20 and 25% less than for kids who are not receiving wraparound services. What we did in this implementation is that originally it was child welfare kids. We expanded it to kids who may be involved in the criminal justice system, kids who may be involved in ED. The care coordinators who are facilitating that planning process, they kind of came online in November, and so we're just starting to see the rollout of that. Wraparound is very complicated because it's not just the child and family planning team, it's also the local communities creating a governance structure so that they are supporting those plans that are developed. So you don't have child welfare fighting with mental health and juvenile justice, that they are supporting the plans that come up out of these child and family teams. And in the situation where we don't have family members who are attached to those kids, because as I said, we are in the business of building relationships, sustaining relationships, and creating relationships. If they don't have relationships, then we find them. Because kids can't make progress in mental health unless they have relationships. And I know we're in a terrible hurry, but I would really like to tell a story, if you would indulge me. And
tell your story, and we'll try to hold questions
Amy,
to allow you
we
to.
We really have to.
All right, no story.
Okay. Thank you.
It was a really good story.
Yeah. We have to.
Yes. So one of the other programs that we rolled out this year is the Oregon Psychiatric Access Line for Kids, OPAL-K. And this is essentially a consultation service for primary care practitioners. It's staffed by psychiatrists. It's real time. If you have a primary care practitioner who calls and needs assistance, basically you can talk to a psychiatrist. Since June 2014, we've enrolled 821 primary care practitioners to be able to use this service. We've had 287 consultation calls, and we've had a 99% satisfaction rate with that service. And essentially, what they've done is basically help primary care manage complex psychiatric cases, and this is particularly important in rural areas where there is, for sure, a child psychiatry shortage. Children's Secure Residential Program. So AMH, we manage 4 secure residential programs and 8 young adult residential treatment homes. And the two of these programs, we have the Secure Children's Inpatient Program, which serves kids who are 5 to 14. We have 11 beds there. And then Secure Adolescent Inpatient Program, we have 26 beds, and that is 14 to 18. These two programs are really important because they serve our highest risk, most vulnerable children. These are not typically just kids who have mental health issues or kids who have complex medical issues. They may have intellectual disabilities. They have other factors that do not make them good candidates for either psychiatric residential treatment or community-based services. In addition to that, we have a Three Bridges program, which serves, it's a secure program, but it serves the 18 to 24-year-olds. And then last but not least, on the residential programs, we have our new CSEC program, which serves commercial sexually exploited children. That program opened in December. It has a total of 12 beds. It serves
young girls, age 11 to 15. Thus far, we have served 8 unique individuals. We have 6 kids in the program currently. I think we're adding another 2 in the next week, and we're continue to build on that and increase services there.
Wow, I'm fast.
Okay. School access to mental health services. This is a really, really important service. As you know, the best way to get to young people who are in need early is to actually have the services be where the kids are. It makes perfect sense. It reduces that barrier of having to make that extra step of having to go to a mental health clinic, and it increases the coordination between schools and mental health clinicians. This service, we currently have mental health clinicians placed in 57 school-based health centers, and then we have we also have clinicians who are placed in non-school-based health centers schools. And the non-school-based health center schools, there were 9 counties that we selected, and we went the direction of going with community mental health programs in part because these clinicians need to be able to see anybody. Schools, I was a school mental health clinician, and basically in the school that I was placed at, if I were to go in there and say, I'm sorry, I can only see OHP clients, I can't help you with your private insurance clients, that drove the school people nuts. I mean, it just drove them absolutely nuts. They have to serve everybody, and the partners they want in the school, they want them to be able to serve everybody too. So we have, with the 9 the 9 counties, they're serving approximately 16 schools. And then obviously we have the 57 school-based health centers. And thus far, within the school-based health centers, 3,167 students received both mental health and primary care services in the 2013 to 2014 school year. 2,105 received only mental health services. And one of the things that we hear fairly frequently from our public health partners is actually the number one reason why kids walk into school-based health centers is actually to get mental health services. So having mental health clinicians attached to those school-based health centers makes perfect sense. And our hope is to actually be able to expand that in this next coming biennium.
Thank you. Let's try to get through just 2 more slides, then that will complete 1 more topic for today. I doubt that you can get through more than that.
Okay. So crisis services. AMH supports detoxification services. We have 6 regional detox centers throughout the state. And we recently invested in these programs so that they could enhance their service capacity to deal with people that have more chronic issues and provide medically monitored detox. We did that in preparation for ACA and health system transformation. We also have short-term stabilization and crisis hotlines. We fund the hotline services that are provided by Lines for Life. And then we also have a hotline for problem gambling services housed at Emergence in Eugene. There are about 219 crisis respite and subacute beds statewide from the last capacity analysis that we did. So, next slide, jail diversion. This was an investment in the 2007 legislative session, but we sent the money out, we allocated it out through counties on a formula basis. This time, when we got new investments, we did an RFP, and we requested proposals, and we were able to fund programs with a more substantial amount of money so that they could really start making a difference. So the jail diversion coupled with mobile crisis has really helped improve coordination and foster formal relationships and partnerships between law enforcement and community mental health services. So you've heard about the successes in Marion County. There have been other successes that we're reading about and hearing about in the reports that we receive back from our contractors. And I think you're going to have more informational session on crisis services, so hopefully that will be brought out in that session. Okay. So we made it through that section.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Ms. Ames to talk about our opportunity to follow up on the crisis services. And Senator Bates, I'm going to ask if you have some additional questions that came up during the community treatment for kids.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, may I, Mrs. Ames, go first?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, working with the agency, we're trying to organize something for your phase two later in April, where we'll try to get a couple of the counties that are doing some interesting things in the mobile crisis services area, including Marion County, to come in with the agency and talk about where some of these new investments have gone and the kinds of things counties are doing with them.
Thank you. And Ms. Baker, I bet we have time for your story in phase two. We're looking forward to it.
Senator Bates.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, when I look at OHA, the major issue is mental health, drug, and alcohol. On the physical side, we put together a process and we put together programs that actually are obviously working. We call them coordinated care plans. And they're pretty well spread across the state. And there's lots of issues there yet. And rate setting and, you know, hospitalization rates and all the kind of things you want to talk about. But at least we've got something that's working. We're measuring outcomes and we're doing better. We're driving down cost and we're making the population healthier physically. In mental health, drug, and alcohol, we're not there yet. We're not there yet. And I know we're trying to get there. I think we're on the cusp, as someone said, maybe of making that jump. But I really want us to focus on the idea that we're not there yet and that we're a long way from getting there if we don't start being bluntly honest with each other about the issue here. And the issue is we have a fragmented system. We don't have wraparound services everywhere. People don't go through one door to get what they need for drug and alcohol and mental health, and then have a great wraparound service afterwards. They end up in prison. A third of the people in prison are there for mental health reasons. People going in to aid and assist has doubled in the last 5 years. We're not getting there. As an example, your school access to mental health. I don't see how that can work. What do you do in nights and weekends and summers? Is that spread in every school across the state? It's episodic care at best. I mean, that is not a system that really works, and I hate to say this publicly. It's a great place to pick up kids that are in trouble and get them into a system that works. But just having it at a school-based health center is a great place to pick them up. I don't see how that system works. June, July, and August, what do these kids do? Saturdays and Sundays, what do? I see them Saturdays and Sundays. I see them on weekends. I pick the stuff up in the health centers at the inappropriate times for them to be treated sometimes. Okay? It's a convenient thing for the providers. It's not convenient, I don't believe, for the people getting the health care they need. So I'm just saying, let's be honest about this. And I don't mean to be on a tirade. I'm not. I want to see change, just as we had the same kind of conversation with physical health over the last 4 or 5 years. And I told people, quit putting lipstick on the pig. Let's fix it in Oregon. And we did. And the bar is low in this country for what needs to be happening. Go to any major city, look under a bridge. You know, it's a bit that we have a lot of work to do, that we can really start doing it if we come together and work together to make it work. Last session, we just threw a bunch of money at a system I don't think functions. And, you know, you try to show us what the gains have been. There have been some, but not the kind of gains we need. We need an organized system of care. I just don't see it here. I see bits and pieces all over the state. And I'm not criticizing you guys. You're doing the best you can. But I just don't see it yet. And until I see it, I'm still going to be uncomfortable. And I'll keep working to make that change.
Thank you, Chairman. Senator. That's about how much time we have for today. Did you have something to add?
Briefly.
Okay.
So I agree that we are a long, long ways from where we need to be in mental health. I'm quite impressed in the progress of the residential treatment facilities over recent years. I was working at Swastik, which is now Kairos, when they opened New Bridges. And if any of you are down in my neck of the woods in Southern Oregon, I would love to go with you and help you set up an appointment to get a tour of those facilities and see some of the impressive work they are doing. But the overall, we're a long ways from where we need to be, but there's some good things happening.
Thank you for that comment, Representative. We will look forward to seeing you all here again tomorrow. We're adjourned. We're adjourned.